we were in the middle of paragraph 43, and we sort of took a detour last week to discuss how the Rambam has a different view of chosenness from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. And of course this is very relevant to Shavuot, because on Shavuos we become the chosen people. And what does it mean to be the chosen people? What does it mean to, what kind of process did we undergo? What kind of transformation took place at Matan Torah? These are all questions that we're going to have difficulty explaining, both according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam. For the Rambam, it's a covenant. There's no essential change that takes place to the Jewish people at the time of Matan Torah, other than the fact that we accepted a covenant upon ourselves and on all future generations. But are we the same? We're still part of the human race. There's nothing different about us. Our neshamas, if you were to dissect us and look at our neshamas under a microscope, if such a thing was doable, then you would find the same neshama for a Jew and for a non-Jew, for the Rambam. And for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, there are essential differences intrinsic to the Jewish people, making them different from non-Jews. However, as we're going to discover, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, those differences originated well before Matan Torah. Well before the Torah was given, there was something inherent within the Jewish genealogy that made us different from the rest of the world. And we're just going to see him touch upon that in the ensuing paragraphs, but we're going to have to wait until towards the end of the first ma'amar, towards the end of the first essay, in order for him to really develop this idea about how the Jewish people stem from some kind of select gene that starts from the very beginning of creation with the very first man, Adam. But we're going to wait on that. But if that's the case, then something happened at Matan Torah, almost a way of activating the gene that the Jewish people always possessed. Sort of an activation of something that may have been latent within the Jewish people as a whole. So that's something that we'll wait and see, because all of those things are going to be described as we go along. But just that you should bear in mind that the stakes of how we describe chosenness within the Jewish people are directly related to how we relate to the experience of Kabbalat Torah, of receiving the Torah on Shavuos. When you and I are going to be listening to the Ten Commandments in the shul and trying to reenact in our own mind, you know, standing there at Har Sinai and accepting the Torah, will we be transformed in an essential way? That whereas before we were one kind of being and now we've been elevated to a new form of being, a new species of creation? Or is there nothing essential that changes within us other than the acceptance of a covenant or a commitment to God? So these are heady issues, important issues. But this is what the issue that really is weighing upon Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and what compels him to discuss this issue so heavily. Now, in the course of describing this fifth order of creation, which for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is the superhuman being who has the ability to have a prophetic experience. So remember, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, what makes the Jewish people superior to all other human beings is the fact that we have the ability to prophesy. We have the ability to have a prophetic experience. Yeah? So if that's the case, then where do we know about this kind of prophetic superhuman being? Where do we learn about such a being? So in the bottom of page 74, with paragraph 43, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, well, what I've just described for you, this kind of superhuman being who can walk through fire and whose face illuminates rays of light and who knows all future events, even when he's the dates that he's going to die. And when it's time for him to die, he dies, lies down peacefully, and his soul departs from him. So all of these things that I've described, that's Moshe Rabbeinu. That's one of our great prophets. And as one of our great prophets, you see that this is documented in the Torah. Now this documentation that's contained in the Torah leads Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi to give us sort of like a short demonstration or a short introduction to what the Torah is. And it starts at the very bottom of page 74, that Moshe told the Jews things that were hidden from them, such as how the world was created, what mankind was like before the great flood. He told them how they were descended from Adam, how the flood occurred, and how the 70 nations of the world all descended from Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Yefet. He told them how the world developed different languages in connection with the Tower of Babel, where the different nations settled, how different crafts developed, and how countries grew. He chronicled for them the years from Adam to the present. So in the course of describing the superhuman Moshe Rabbeinu, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi tells us something else. And he tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu in the Torah actually chronicled human history from the time of Adam to his lifetime. And the question is, why is this relevant to our understanding of what it means to occupy a fifth level of creation? What is the connection between describing Moshe as the superhuman being that the Jewish people are capable of being and the fact that Moshe chronicled all of human history? Because if you look at the next paragraph, paragraph 44, we should select a reader for today. Who can we get a volunteer to do our reading for today?
I would do it if I had one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Paragraph 44. This is it. The Kuzari said, "If you truly have an exact reckoning of the years from the time of creation, this too is amazing."
Why is this such an amazing thing? Why is it such an amazing thing that we have a chronicling from all of human history from the time of creation to the time of the giving of the Torah, and actually to the present day? Well, let's see how he continues. Read 45, please.
The rabbi said, "We use this number in our calendars. No two Jews argue about this dating, no matter where they dwell."
Isn't that interesting? No two Jews ever argue about what date it is. We argue just about everything else. You know, you eat gebrachs, I don't eat gebrachs. You eat kidneyot, I don't eat kidneyot. Right? But what day Pesach is, what day Yom Kippur is, we all agree upon. It's actually going to be a polemical argument that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to use in the third essay, in his arguments against the Karaites. Now, the Karaites are a certain sect of Jews who believed in the written Torah but didn't believe in Torah Sheba'al Peh. They didn't believe in an oral tradition. And as you probably know, the Jewish calendar is a very complicated system that is based upon an oral tradition that the rabbis had about how to calculate the 12-month lunar cycle and intercalating a 13th month every two or three years based upon creating a reconciliation between the lunar and solar calendars. Yeah? And it's very, very complex and it's very complicated, and there's a 19-year cycle. And the question, of course, is, that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi asks, is, as do you Karaites celebrate the same day of Yom Kippur as we do? And the Karaite, of course, has to acknowledge, yes, we have the same calendar dates. But if you don't accept Torah Sheba'al Peh, if you don't accept an oral tradition, then how can you even start to know when the Jewish holidays are? Because you can't even get started in your observance of Judaism unless you rely on some oral tradition that tells you how to calculate Jewish dates. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is not going to go into that right now, but bear in mind that this is extremely relevant to the concept of a tradition, of a tradition that is both written and oral, that dates back to the time of creation. And one of the proofs is that we Jews today claim that we know exactly what date it is from the time of creation. From the time of creation, it's 5,772 years from the time of creation. We are now the first day of Sivan of the year 5772. No two Jews disagree about that. And we date this back using the calculations that are based upon the dates that are given in the Torah, and then dates since that time that are defined by our sages. And when I say creation, I don't mean from the time that heaven and earth were created. I mean from the time of the creation of Adam, because that's really what the year 5772 refers to, the date of the first human being. Okay? So, why is that relevant? Why should Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi bring up this discussion specifically now when we are talking about this very controversial subject of superhumanity, of the Jewish people occupying a higher order of organism than the rest of humanity? Any ideas why this is something that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi would want to raise now about the faithfulness or the accuracy of our traditions? What do you think the connection is? This took me a while to figure out, by the way, so. Yes, go ahead.
I think it's an unbroken chain. So it's showing that since human beings know that they existed, we have an unbroken chain.
We do have an unbroken chain. How is that relevant to his discussion of the fifth order of... That's exactly the point. He's trying to represent...
But Moshe could figure it out well.
So in other words, you have to be of a prophetic nature in order to be able to have this information. Is that...
Our oral tradition probably also would have helped with that.
Yeah. Okay, all right. I think you're on the right track. Took me a while to figure this out. Go back to page 71, end of paragraph 25. There are a number of subtexts that are taking place at the same time in the course of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's discussion, and really it's very important for you to know that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi writes in the same way that he wrote poetry. And that he, when you're a poet, you don't just write in a linear fashion, one idea, second idea, third idea, fourth. You're combining a bunch of different colors in a palette and presenting them in a free-flowing fashion. That's the way a poet writes. Even when he's writing prose, when you read a novel, there are many different plots that are going on at the same time, right? And they all weave themselves together into what the experience of life is all about. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi writes in that fashion, and he is a great poet, as we know from the other writings that he presented to us throughout his life. And he writes Jewish philosophy in a poetic fashion as well. And so when he's presenting us with ideas, he's presenting us with ideas that flow in and out of each other, right? That weave in and out of each other. So the first thing that he did when he presented what the rabbi was saying is that the whole basis of our tradition and our belief in God and our belief in everything that we believe is not based upon intellect, but it's based upon an unbroken chain of transmission going back to Sinai. And that's why he says at the top of page 71, he says, this is how I started to respond when you asked me about my faith. I answered what I and the rest of the Jewish people are obliged to believe based on our firsthand encounter with God at Mount Sinai. We have passed down this account without interruption from generation to generation. And so even today, it is as if we are eyewitnesses to that event. Now that's a big pill to swallow. It's one thing to say that when we were all at Mount Sinai, we experienced God face to face. But how can you tell me that today in the 21st century or in the 12th century when HaLevi is writing this, that it's as if we're eyewitnesses to the events that we experienced at Har Sinai? The answer is that if you have an unbroken chain that defies falsification, and he's going to explain how we have a fairly good idea, we can be fairly certain that the stories that were passed down to us from generation to generation were not falsified and were not doctored. And we haven't proved that yet, but we're going to try and prove that later. So if you have an unbroken chain of transmission from one generation to the next, then it's as if you're eyewitnesses to the event yourself. I promise you, we will spend more time discussing that, but part of the tradition that we have is that we as the Jewish people occupy a special status because of the special covenant that God made with us at Mount Sinai. And in order to be able to verify all the things that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going to try and present to us about the special status of the Jewish people, he has to constantly weave into this argument the idea that what I'm presenting to you now is not just the opinion of one person based upon the speculation of his own mind, but rather based on a tradition. This is Jewish tradition. This is what's been passed down to us. So this is why we have sort of the authority, we have the historical authority to be able to present to you our religion in a far stronger way than anyone else, any other cleric who's going to come to you and say that our way is correct. Judaism has a very strong proof to the fact that it's true, that it's correct, based upon our transmission process that has been unbroken from generation to generation, going back even to the time of creation. And so we have a record of everything that is recorded in, from the time of creation to the present. We have a timeline, and we use that timeline even today in our observances of Judaism. So this is going to help foster, helps to sort of bolster and support the argument that he's making that the Jewish people are special. Okay? Yeah.
Question. First of all, in paragraph 43, it was through Moshe that the Jews learned of the whole things that were hidden from them, such as how the world was created. So the implication is that the Jews didn't know about the origin of the world. It took Moshe.
Right. The Jews themselves did not know because they were a slave class and that a lot of this stuff was lost to them. Moshe had to reintroduce it to them because he was educated directly from Hashem. But from the time of Moshe, there has been an unbroken chain of transmission from that time to the present. Yeah.
Is it Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's opinion that the Jews were predestined to be who they were, that no other nation had the ability to be who they were, or is it that because of the Torah, that's what made them special?
That's a really good question. It's going to become clear as we go through the text that it was a predestination. Now, when I say predestination, we get into some cloudy theology. Obviously, when God created the world, he knew all of human history that would unfold. And from God's point of view, there was going to be one nation that was going to be chosen, that was going to be the Jewish people. God knew the future when he created. Like the Chazal say, Histakel Beoraisa Ubara Alma, and God looked into the Torah as the blueprint, and he created the world based upon the Torah that he had written in advance of creation. So God, of course, knows that the Jewish people are destined. But the question really that you're asking is was there any predisposition that the Jewish people possessed before coming to Har Sinai that made them more prone to receive the Torah than any other nation?
Well, I have an additional question. If the Jews had this special gene, does that mean that the nations of the world never had the ability to become the Jewish people? It's only the Jewish people.
Right. So, yes, this is a very important issue. This is very important for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Because the implication of what he's suggesting is that the special gene that we possess started with Adam, and it was passed down from generation to generation. And it seems like it goes, if it's purely a genetic process, then it doesn't involve free will. It doesn't involve the ability for other human beings to acquire the gene. You don't just acquire the gene through effort. You have to be genetically predisposed to something. And so it doesn't seem that there was any merit involved in the Jewish people becoming the chosen people. Now, the truth of the matter is, and maybe we'll spend more time just on your question alone today, which is great in and of itself. There's a tremendous benefit in subscribing to the belief that the Jewish people did not earn their status as the chosen people based on merit, but rather there was some predisposition that we had genetically. You know what the benefit that you get is from that? Okay? The benefit is that you can never have it rescinded. And if you live in a time when Christianity says that Jews have been replaced. There's a replacement theology. That the Jewish people's chosen status has been replaced by Christendom. Then this kind of theology does not allow for such a position, because it basically says you can't replace, like if I have a gene that allows me to jump 10 feet high in the air, right? You can't just say, well, because of your merits, you've acquired my gene. It doesn't happen that way. There can be no exchange, because even before the Torah was given to the Jewish people, it wasn't based on a meritocracy. It wasn't based on the merits of the Jewish people that we became the chosen people. And therefore, even if we rejected your Messiah, that merit does not leave us. Just like we didn't acquire that merit through, or that special gene through merit, so too we don't lose the gene through demerit. Even by your own argument that we made a terrible mistake by rejecting God's Son, God's Messiah, right? And so we forfeited something, but we couldn't have forfeited our chosenness. Our chosenness was integral to our being well before we received the Torah. So that's the benefit. Am I making myself clear?
How about problems with that? Because the whole thing we're taught in Torah is that Abraham rose above the world by recognizing God and going through all the aseres and sionos and sacrificing, or the Kedah Yitzchak. So that kind of goes against everything we're taught that we...
It seems to go against everything that we know that the Torah seems to be indicating about Abraham, and certainly what Chazal say, that Abraham merited that. But at the same time, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is not alone. The Maharal, in his work Netzach Yisrael, has a very important essay to emphasize this very point. He says, don't think that God chose Abraham because he was a tzaddik. And he says, I'll prove it to you. You know, when you look at the beginning of Parshas Noach, it says, Eile toldos Noach. Noach ish tzadik tamim haya bedorotav et ha'elokim italech Noach. When we get introduced to Noah, before in the parsha before Lech Lecha, it says, these are the generations of Noach. Noach was a righteous man. He was pure in his generation. He walked with God. Now, if you were going to be introduced to the very first Jew, Avraham Avinu, wouldn't you at least expect some kind of intro at least as good as Noah? Eile toldos Avraham. Avram ish tzadik tamim haya bedorotav et ha'elokim italech Avraham. And therefore, vayomer Elokim el Avram lech lecha me'artzecha. Right? That should have been the introduction to Parshas Lech Lecha. It should have been, let me tell you a little bit about this man, Avram. He was a righteous man, unique in his generation, walked purely with God. And as a result, God said to Avram, get thee from thy land and go to the land which I shall show thee. That's not what the Torah says. Torah says specifically something quite different between, and to create a contrast between Noah and Avraham Avinu. Noah merited to have his family save the world because of his merit, because of his righteousness. Avraham was not chosen to be the father of the Jewish people because of his merit, because of his righteousness. Now that's difficult to reconcile with all of the things that you talked about, where Chazal seemed to indicate that it was because of his merit that God chose him. So perhaps we have to modify our understanding of Chazal in light of what we're demonstrating now. And that is, Avraham was predestined and was predetermined because of his genealogy to be the father of the Jewish people. But he also had the free choice to reject that heritage, to reject his genealogy. And had he chosen of his own free will to go to Vegas instead of going to Canaan, then the Jewish people would have never come to fruition. We never would have come into being. So while God chose Avram to be the father of the chosen people, Avram had to agree to the task. And the only way that Avram could agree to be the father of the Jewish people was by going through experiences and passing tests to demonstrate that he was ready to assume that mantle. But he was not chosen because of his righteousness. He was chosen because of his predestined genealogy, and then he had to accept the mantle of leadership. The Maharal says a similar thing by Moshe Rabbeinu as well, by the way. Is it making more sense now? So this is the benefit that we gain, because now the Jewish people can never be superseded based upon either our lack of merit or the fact that we made bad choices. So this theology becomes very important in a post-temple world after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. And there's this tremendous cognitive dissonance the Jewish people can't understand, cannot reconcile. How is it that a chosen people that are supposed to be God's people are ground into the dust of humanity, of human civilization, and are dispersed throughout the world? How can such a thing be? And therefore, we have to be able to reaffirm to ourselves that, right, as even as we learned in, we read in this week's Parsha, right, that even when you are dispersed among the nations, lo azavtim velo me'astim, I will not forsake you, God says God, I will never despise you, you will always still be mine. Right? Even when you are sent out into the diaspora, you will still be the chosen people. And it's precisely because of this theology that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is describing, that the Jewish people's chosenness is not transferable and is not revocable. Okay? Someone else wanted to raise a point? Yeah.
Well, I think the way that we perceive this, like the genetic chosenness, I mean, we take this like big thing about how, you know, we accepted the Torah, right? But that's the chosenness that we can't revoke. That's us today. And there is a lot to thinking like that, because that's the message we have to give our children.
That we have the obligation to...
Right, we don't do adult baptism, right? Like, we have our children are Jewish, period. And
our children are... You're born Jewish, you're Jewish, you get a bris when you're 8 days old, whether you want it or not, right?
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's it. We're born into it because of our chosenness, not because of our commitment to it. Now, the same thing that I mentioned about Avraham Avinu, as far as his predisposition or predestination for being the father of the chosen people, would apply, it would presumably apply for Kabbalah Satorah as well. That we as the Jewish people were chosen, pre-chosen, to be given the Torah. But just because we were pre-chosen for it doesn't mean that we didn't have free will to reject it. We had the option still of rejecting it. And Lars, you could have a child in your family that you feel is ready to go to Harvard. Right? And you've put away all the money in the scholarship fund, and you have been saving up since the time that he's 6 months old, and putting away the money because you went to Harvard, so your son's going to go to Harvard as well. And then all of a sudden he becomes 18 and he says, I want to start a rock band. Right? So does that mean that that he was never meant to go to Harvard? No, he was meant to go to Harvard, right? Just he decided he was going to start a rock band instead. He has the ability to go to Harvard. It's not just not what he made a different decision, made a different life decision. So the same thing happened with the Jewish people. Hashem created us to receive the Torah, but we still had the will, the opportunity to reject it. Now, had we rejected it, the world would have gone back to tohu vavohu, according to our sages. The world would have been destroyed. Had we not accepted the Torah, the Gemara in Shabbat says that God says, I would have put the world back to chaos and void, because that would have defeated the whole purpose of creation. So fortunately, we accepted the Torah. But that statement of the sages really only confirms that there was this predestination, this predetermination, that the Jewish people were the ones chosen to receive the Torah. For, you know, using all of this preponderance of evidence to support Rabbi Yehuda Halevi makes the Rambam a little bit more difficult. But there's a way to work the Rambam in through all of the theology as well. Yeah?
I have 2 points. First point, in the past, when Rabbi Yehuda Halevi tells that it's a history of humanity, he actually invites Kuzari to be a witness, because humanity knows more or less its own history. And he is impressed by the fact that Jews know the history. It's kind of one of the additional...
That's a very good observation that you're making. And... there's a very good reason for this, is because one of the points that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going to raise is that the Torah rings true. How does the Torah ring true? One of the ways that the Torah rings true is that it makes claims about human history that you wouldn't make if you were going to fabricate the story. If you were going to make up a story about what happened 800 years ago, you wouldn't say that 800 years ago everyone was speaking one language. That just doesn't seem plausible, because most people have a record of what happened 800 years ago, even if it's only a vague record of what happened 800 years ago. But there would seem to be some kind of legacy that we would have from people who lived 800 years ago, and if there was more than one language spoken, we would probably find some tablets, some excavation, some archaeology that would indicate that there was more than one language. The fact that the Torah can make the claim, as Moshe Rabbeinu did to the Jewish people, that 800 years ago there was this place called Shinar, and everyone was living there, and everyone was speaking one language, and all of a sudden, boom, in a split second, there were 70 languages, whereas before there was just one, makes that claim plausible, because it would have been much easier, if Moshe Rabbeinu was a liar, it would have been much easier to come up with a more believable story. So that's something we're going to develop. What was your second point?
And my second point, because we're going to the mashal of genetics, the spiritual genetics, we can develop it into the idea of genome. There is an idea that circumstances person finds itself affect, or the gene is called up to act, or it changes. For example, we know now if somebody can be diabetic but lives healthy lifestyle, he has a chance, or transmit the gene to his children, or actually up to four generations.
So all those points you raise are excellent points. We're going to be discussing as we go along, but again, I'm going to defer that discussion for later in the first essay. We will be discussing how the gene evolves, how it mutates a little bit, and how, in addition to just the gene, you need to have certain external conditions, certain physical conditions, in order to activate the gene. So, just now, you're talking about a genetic disposition to something negative, like diabetes or something like that. What if you have a genetic disposition to being superhuman? Just because you maybe have this disposition to being a great athlete, for example, doesn't mean that all of a sudden you can wake up in the morning and become an NBA basketball player. You have to go through the training, you have to get a coach, you have to learn what to do, you have to go to a certain place to train. So all of these things are going to be developed by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the same, using that same model that you discussed. Yes?
Why was the Torah given so long after creation? Why wasn't it given to Noah if it was such a tzaddik?
That's a great question. The sages address this question. The sages say that the Torah was given 26 generations after the creation of Adam. And really, God had wanted to give the Torah to humanity 1,000 generations after humanity. The reason is because as humankind, as civilization advances, it becomes more mature in many different ways. I think we could arguably say that we have eliminated certain things in modern civilization from a societal point of view, that as far as racial prejudices and gender prejudices and discrimination and persecution and slavery and so many things that existed in previous eras that don't exist today because we have advanced in certain ways as a civilization. HaKadosh Baruch Hu really wanted human beings to mature sociologically before giving them the Torah. And he felt that we would have to mature for 1,000 generations in order for us to properly appreciate the Torah. However, Hashem saw that the world could not endure for 1,000 generations without a Torah. And so what he did was, and this medrash needs to be developed further, but he wrote the Torah 974 generations before he created the world, so that the Torah would at least have its own independent maturation for 1,000 generations, so that 26 generations into the world's existence, he could give the Torah, so that the Torah would have at least it itself, in isolation, would have matured a total of 1,000 generations. So whatever that means, it basically what the I think the message that Chazal are sending to us is that Adam was not ready to receive the Torah. As a civilization, mankind was not ready to receive the Torah until it had developed a little bit further in the course of its evolutionary process. I don't mean evolution in the scientific term. I mean evolution in a sociological term. Okay? Let's hold it here. Yes?
Would that just not suggest that then Hashem got it wrong? That he thought that the world would be ready and it wasn't, or that people would develop. Like Hashem knows everything, he would have known if it were not planned for 1,000 years, but sooner.
This medrash is part of it. This medrash, that's a very good question. This medrash is part of an entire genre of midrash which suggests that the world is less than perfect and that God could have made it perfect, but due to the flaws that are built into creation, he had to accommodate for those flaws. And that's a much larger topic which we won't develop today.